wall. But the obstacle was not made of stone. He needed to know that Betsy would be waiting, of which he was reasonably sure. If Betsy was a regular visitor to Home Farm, and she'd been there a day or two before, would this be the best place from which to snatch her to safety? These thoughts occupied him as the three women disappeared indoors. But about what were they speaking? With Sarah Lovell present, he doubted it would be about him, unless it was deeply unflattering. Now they were out of sight, he could allow his thinking free rein, even if, in doing so, he visited upon himself the maximum degree of discomfort. To add to that and complicate any half-formed plans, he saw the two coachmen from Cottington take up station without the gate, one with a fowling piece very prominently displayed. Precautions were being taken, a notion no doubt emanating from Betsy's brother. Chapter 22. The previous meeting with Annabel Colpoys had been bizarre. This one was even more so. At least Roger, with his forced cheerfulness, was absent, but two of this trio of women were engaged in a strained conversation with only Sarah Lovell, seemingly impervious to the atmosphere. In some ways, she was acting as if a different person, less self-contained, talking, indeed quietly boasting about her life prior to coming to live at Cottington Court. Annabel did not know her as well as Betsy. Her aunt was not a regular visitor to Home Farm, in truth no visitor at all, unless part of a general social gathering, so Annabel had to be less aware of the change in her behaviour. While seemingly listening in rapt attention to the level of the Lovell couple's social preeminence, the two friends were trying to communicate by look and slight gestures, an almost impossible message to convey.
"I think it is fair to reflect that our opinion mattered," was imparted with smug satisfaction. "Mr. Lovell was admired for his sage commercial advice, while I know that my good opinion on the behaviour of the society to which we were part..."
"Surely you mean the society of which you were leader, Aunt Sarah?"
Betsy interrupted. There followed a remarkably quick transformation in expressions. First, the self-righteous look disappeared, to be replaced for no more than a split second by the pinched appearance of someone who knew she was being challenged. But that evaporated just as swiftly to be replaced with a condescending smile.
"One does not like to boast, Elizabeth, but you are, of course, correct. My opinion was canvassed by many on the merits or otherwise of any proposed action, which might even have marginally detracted from the accepted norms. Standards had to be maintained, for if they are not, what ensues?"
"You are so right, Mrs. Lovell,"
Annabel interjected, clearly seeking to strike a middle way, but managing to get in a barb as well, given she was looking at Betsy.
"The behaviour of some people beggars belief."
Sarah Lovell had no choice but to agree. But her niece had some hope she might be drawn to reflecting on her own actions. In the very short silence that followed, Betsy and Annabel exchanged another look which had within it the slightest nod, an attempt to pass the message that the note had been delivered. The response was so vague, Annabel had no idea if her friend had got it. Betsy's mind was operating on two levels, the first obvious. But she was also wondering if she should burst this bubble of self-aggrandizement in which her aunt was indulging, for she knew it to be gross exaggeration. There was a temptation to ask her where, said Mr. Lovell, that paragon of advice on money matters, was now. It had ended up with both of them living off Tulkington charity. How much other people knew about her misfortunes was moot. She never openly discussed it, even within her adopted home, and it was not even extensively aired by the family. This was not from a feeling of disgrace, but from an assurance that it was no one else's business. Samuel Lovell had upped and left without explanation, and it seemed crass to over-inquire. Thus the surprise was total,
when Sarah Lovell addressed the point directly, quite forgetting some of the things she had just said.
"I cannot tell you how badly my husband took it, to find that people in whom he placed absolute trust were so dishonest in the most egregious way. He was brought low by trust, Mrs. Colpoys."
The look aimed at Betsy was flinty in its defiance. It seemed to say, "Check me if you dare."
"But he is an astute man of affairs, and is, I am sure, working to repair both his reputation and our position in society."
He'd been gone for years. Being well-raised, she did battle with the desire to tell the truth, but what won over all was the need to keep this woman on side, to challenge this utter farrago of an explanation for being deserted by her husband would be futile. Likewise, undermining her claim to social prominence. Nothing Betsy had heard in the years since her aunt had shared Cottington led her to suspect there was even a sliver of truth in any of her assertions. It was not hard to see through what was being implied, that Samuel Lovell, through shame at his position, had gone off in secret and without explanation to repair his fortune, and would return in triumph when that happy state had been achieved, to reconnect with the woman he loved and had so disappointed.
"Men do too often suffer from feelings of shame."
Annabel said this with a sad face, leaving Betsy wondering if she was talking about Roger. Sarah Lovell was looking at her in a funny way which hinted at the notion her wholly imagined, sainted Samuel was being made to sound vapid. But there was added a soothing addendum.
"And the pity is, they will not share the burden. For despite their common opinion, we women are stronger than they by some margin."
"How very right you are, Mrs. Colpoys," was the firm agreement from an enthused Aunt Sarah. "They are frailer than they know."
"Some men are, of course, strong on the course they have set, and I'm sure your husband will be that."
If Sarah Lovell preened in agreement and was so busy feeling vindicated, she failed to notice the last remark was aimed directly at her niece, who got the message clearly. Annabel was telling her Edward Brazier would not waver. She was thus happy when her aunt declared they should be going.
"I would wish to be allowed to call again, Mrs. Colpoys," Sarah Lovell said when she was back in her cloak, which got an odd look from her hostess. "In the company of Elizabeth, of course. I know how close you are to each other."
"You are most welcome to call, as is Betsy, although I would wish for some prior warning. With 3 children to see to, I must be sure I can offer you proper attention."
"I think you will find, Mrs. Colpoys, that when it comes to the proper exercise of good manners, there are few who can surpass me."
It was as well she turned away then to take her gloves from the waiting servant, which allowed her to miss the look of fury on Annabel's face, quickly masked as she addressed Betsy, moving to embrace her.
"You know you're always welcome. Perhaps you could call on us, Annabel, and bring the children over to play in the woods and around the lake, which we used to do ourselves."
Just about to agree, the response was dampened.
"Yes, Elizabeth, we must inquire of Henry if that would be appropriate."
"Gone?
Gone where?"
"I believe it was to visit Home Farm, sir,"
Grady responded, ignoring the glare that went with the question. As usual, he kept his eyes from contact, aiming them just above his master's head. "Again?" was larded with suspicion. "And who came up with that notion?"
That was not an inquiry to which it would be wise to respond, so Grady did not.
He waited for what was to follow, but that merely turned out as a demand to tell him when they returned. "I will be in my study. Fetch me some coffee." On the way there, and once settled at his desk, Henry sought to deduce if there'd been anything in Upton's expression to arouse suspicion. The fact that he had, once dismounted, pushed aside the boy sent to bring in his horse, and instead led his own mount into the stables, was singular. He rarely visited the stables or the stud farm, having little interest in matters equine outside the value gained from the sales. With what Creevy had told him, added to a memory of his sister's love of riding as well as looking after horses, there were good grounds to be suspicious. Elizabeth had spent much time in the stables, and as a young woman insisted on grooming her own animals, and even, on occasion, mucking out their stalls. He could well recall the obnoxious stink of horse piss and damp straw that attended her when she came in from carrying out such menial tasks. Also a memory was her being distraught when they died, or fell so ill they had to be put out of their misery. It was an attraction he had never understood. A horse was a means of conveyance, nothing else. Which took his mind back to Upton. Was there a difference in his attitude, enough to warrant a feeling of disquiet? And then there'd been that damned blacksmith banging away at horseshoes to kill any chance of subtle inquiries. He could not put a finger on anything specific other than a vague suspicion. More pressing was the fact of that second visit to the Colpoys, which could only have been sanctioned by his aunt. And that was troubling. A week ago she would not have dared act in such a fashion without consulting him first. The knock brought him coffee and biscuits, plus the news that he was being called upon by the Reverend Joshua Moyle, which, initially unwelcome, quickly came to be seen as the very opposite, a distraction. After a trying day in which he'd travelled far and encountered some success as well as one intractable problem, the thought of sharing a glass or two with Moyle, whose antics always amused him, appealed. There would be no challenge in it apart from the effort to avoid going glass for glass with the divine, for Joshua Moyle was a toper of quite exceptional ability. His faith was the opposite. Skin deep, and wholly to do with self-interest, he would act, and had, in whatever capacity Henry Tulkington wanted in order to keep his living. It was probably the only sentiment wholly shared by his long-suffering wife. Few dispensers of such offices would employ Moyle, while the church probably reckoned him an embarrassment. "Best fetch the brandy, Grady, and some wine for me." It was rare to see Moyle sober. Even in such a state he looked far from the priest he should be. His clothing tended to the unkempt, his waistcoat a repository for much of the snuff that missed his nostrils. His face was cratered with veins, and the hair was wild, grey and unruly. That admitted, he was generally a cheerful soul. But not this day. Having greeted Henry in serious mien, he sat down heavily and addressed him with gravity.
"Had the oddest inquiry today from the diocese."
"On what?" That got Henry a jaundiced look, as if to say there was only one matter that was germane.
"About the wedding."
Any response had to wait till Grady had knocked, come in, and placed the drinks ordered on the desk. Eyeing the bottle of brandy, Moyle surprised both when he said in a serious tone,
"Best stick to coffee for now."
"That will be all, Grady." Door closed. Henry inquired, "What kind of query?"
"Was it properly done?"
"And your response?"
"Unequivocally, yes. But why was the question being posed?"
"You might know that better than I."
"It wouldn't have been asked had there not been someone babbling.
I haven't had a visit from the bishop's chaplain since I took up my post here, but there he was yesterday looking through the register and asking about the weddings I've conducted." "Of which there are not many, Moyle." There was a pointed reference in that. Anyone of social standing locally would not use Cottington for the ceremony. They would apply to St. Leonard's in Upper Deal, and in the odd exception, to St. George's. The Tulkingtons themselves rarely visited, only attending at Christmas, Easter, and the various festivals like the harvest, all occasions that brought to the pews the estate workers. Henry was obliged to attend as lord of the manor.
Why was he asking, though?
What did he say, apart from looking at the register?
That it might be time I paid a visit to the bishop, who, it was pointed out, I had never paid my respects to since his appointment.
A short trip to Dover will do you no harm, Henry said in a jocular way.
It's not amusing. The ceremony I carried out was...
The jocose manner evaporated in an instant as Henry barked, "Correct in every way, Moyle." The rheumy eyes watered slightly, a sure sign of self-pity.
"If you insist on it being so."
"Which I do. Now, for the sake of the Lord, if not the Bishop in Canterbury, have some brandy, lest I think there's been a second coming."
"If it's referred up to the Archbishop, well, what then?"
Moyle threw up his hands at such a prospect. The supreme head of the Anglican Church was not a man he ever wished to meet. Henry forbore to say the chances were slight from a divine who spent most of his time living in Lambeth Palace, so as to be close to both government and royalty. Because of his near-permanent absence, the incumbent in Dover was given oversight of the Canterbury diocese. Henry poured a brandy and took it to Moyle, holding it close enough under his nose to allow the fumes to rise. The man was in a faraway mood, no doubt imagining all sorts of ecclesiastical difficulties. His hand took the goblet absent-mindedly, and the act of putting to his lips followed in the same manner. "We must hold steady, Moyle," Henry said.
"Aye,"
came with a blast of bottled-up air. It occurred to Henry, watching him, that there was a danger of him admitting the truth of Elizabeth's wedding. It was as likely to come from drunkenness as from guilty sobriety, which was a worry to add to the several he already had. The knock at the door brought Grady again.
"Mrs. Lovell and your sister have returned, sir."
"Do you not mean Grady?" came the icy response. "Mrs. Lovell and Mrs. Spafford." The whole contents of Moyle's brandy glass disappeared down his throat.
"Henry, if she's left to mope around the house, she will do something dangerous to test your constraints."
Sarah Lovell put down her soup spoon and spoke with real emphasis.
"Let me take her to meet her friends and acquaintances, which will help to lance her frustrations. Elizabeth needs time."
Henry, looking into his own bowl, wanted to respond by saying she needed the whip and always had. But that was held back. He was seeking to adjust to his aunt's very obvious and newfound air of confidence. Previously, she had ever been careful to avoid direct eye contact. Now she was looking at him in a manner very close to being a test. Yet he could hardly argue against her point regarding time being a healer, one he himself had cogitated upon. "Perhaps Elizabeth and I should speak to each other directly."
"I doubt she would readily agree."
"Then I look to you to persuade her." He snarled. Again, there was the difference. Instead of being cowed by his blast of frustration, she held his gaze, as if to say to him, "Such a request is mine to accede to or deny."
"I have things to convey to her which I think might mitigate her hostility."
They had to wait while servants came to remove the soup plates and put before them the broiled chicken, potatoes and vegetables that had been ordered for dinner. Then Grady had to pour the right wine for that course before withdrawing, having ensured all was well.
"Those things are?"
"Certain facts I have come across, Aunt Sarah, which may temper this mad passion for that damned sailor."
"Henry!"
He did apologize for his language, but it was perfunctory. A man had a right to blaspheme in his own house. "Let me just say, Brazier
is not the paragon Elizabeth sees him to be.
He is 10 times the man you will ever be, Henry.
That came from the doorway in which Betsy stood, her face a mask of fury. If she thought it would throw her brother, she was mistaken. He produced one of those humorless smiles she so detested. I wonder if you will hold to that when he's being taken up the Newgate steps to have a rope put around his neck. Or will you choose, unlike myself, to bear witness to the justified demise of a convicted murderer? It was Henry's turn to be thrown as Betsy let forth with a laugh.
I never had you down for a fool, Henry. A misery, yes.
Close the damn door! A shocked Sarah Lovell put her napkin to her mouth, though whether it was brought on by blasphemy or noise was unknowable. Are we to have our conversations held in the hearing of the servants?
Why hide from them what they already know, brother, and have done since you were first able to talk? Your servants despise you as much as I now do. To think I recommended so recently that you should seek a wife. God forbid such a fate should befall one of my sex.
Perhaps I should bring Spafford back to Cottington and lock you both in a room. Would you be so spirited then, I wonder?
If you do, I should send for an undertaker, for one of us will not emerge alive.
With that, the door was slammed, with Sarah Lovell opining in a soft and very disapproving voice,
Henry, such references are untoward.
The day had started well and gone to the bad. First, his frustration at not being able to extract proper redress from Sowerby. Then coming home to his suspicions of Upton and getting nowhere. The annoyance of finding both his sister and aunt out of the house without his permission rankled. Finally came Moyle and his fear of the damned bishop. Put together, it was enough to make his blood boil. It certainly had an effect on his response to being checked on the matter of carnality. Aunt Sarah, it has never been my way to tell you to shut up, although it is often warranted, but I do so now. Either stick to eating your dinner, or go and leave me in peace. Henry was never to know that in her new-found confidence, she addressed him as she would her absent husband, just as she would never acknowledge the possibility that her constant carping, which had been bad before he lost all their money but had made her a termagant afterwards, might be what had driven him away.
I will leave you, Henry, but in peace. That I doubt you deserve.
Chapter 23. If there had been little wisdom in observing Home Farm, there was possibly even less in what Brazier did when the coach had departed. Dutchy, who had him in view, saw him rise up and head down the hill, there being little doubt where he was headed, which had him call to the others. We're underway, lads, and I reckon heading for stormy waters.
Well, leastways I won't be seasick,
Pedler complained.
There'd be out in my gut to puke up.
He was at the gate by the time they were halfway down the hill, with Dutchy calling a halt.
We can see from here if there be trouble.
The dogs alerted the occupants of the farm to Brazier's presence, rushing to bark through the bars of the gate with more excitement than threat. Of the few people around, there was one elderly fellow with a long pipe in his mouth, who saw it as his duty to come and inquire of his business. As he was approaching, Brazier caught sight of a trio of young faces full of curiosity at an upstairs window.
I would like to see Mrs. Colpoyett.
And who should I say is a calling, sir?
Just tell her it's a naval officer. She will require no more. And also tell her I will not depart until we have spoken.
The old fellow blinked, and his jaw started working as he sought to make sense of the reply by chewing. But whether it eluded him or fired his imagination, he did as he was bid and went to the front door of the house, a servant answering his knock. It made Brazier curious as to why they'd not responded before,
They must have heard the dogs, now wagging their tails and competing for affection. It was several minutes before Annabel Colpoys came to the door to look out at him, but she failed to move from there or indicate that he should enter. Her confusion, obvious. Tempted to shout and reassure her, he stopped himself. That would probably drive her back indoors. Finally, she must have decided having him in the house was more discreet than any public exchange. So she told the servant to fetch him in. Brazier was struck again by a touch of nostalgia on entry, for if the exterior of the farm and house evoked memories, so did the interior. There was none of the finery of Cottington. This was a working, occupied household, and if the furniture was of decent quality, it showed it had been subjected to human usage. It felt like home.
I promise not to stay long.
You'd better not, for my husband will be home shortly, and he is prone to the horsewhip, if aroused.
It would not serve to say he would be prone to a ducking or a clout with a club if he tried. So he acknowledged the right. He was, after all, a strange man, by his half, with his wife when he was absent. People had been shot for less. I saw your visitors come and go.
I guessed as much, otherwise you would not be here.
I need to know.
She cut across him. Betsy has been told of the delivery.
And?
And what?
Came querulously.
I suppose you wish to know if there was a response. Well, let me tell you, even to allude to you with Betsy's aunt present was impossible. I'm sure I managed to convey to her that you are not downhearted.
Hardly true,
he said softly. You know what I mean, that you are determined to save her. How that is to be achieved, I do not know, and neither do I want to know. Now, you've come for that which you required. Oblige me by departing.
I want
Captain Brazier. I have already told you I am not prepared to be your messenger.
Then be Betsy's. All I ask is that you find out if she is willing to be rescued from Cottington Court. By the fact she has an armed escort, I suspect it cannot be done elsewhere without great risk.
Armed escort?
Which meant she had not seen them. Explained, it did nothing to cheer her mood.
This will end badly.
It depends on for whom. Find out if she's willing and leave the rest to me, that's all I ask.
In itself it is a great deal.
If I were to call again in a couple of days?
No.
Because it might embarrass you with your husband?
Are you witless? You have already embarrassed me with my husband. Do you not think he will hear of the calling of a stranger, one I invited into his house? He will be told of it as soon as he returns, and if not by one of the farmhands, then by a servant.
Or perhaps your children, whom I saw at their window.
She slowly shook her head.
Surely you can explain.
You do not know my Roger.
I can stay and do so if you wish.
That got a small, breathy laugh.
Go, please. I doubt I will be able to deliver your message, but I will try for the sake of my dear friend.
And how will I know the answer?
You must leave me to find a way to solve that. But oblige me by never calling at Home Farm again. I want that as a promise, for I believe you to be a man of your word.
You have it, and thank you. How much better it would have been if we'd become acquainted at a wedding.
Once he had gone, Annabel sat and pondered for an age. That was until the children, free of any lessons, their afternoon session having ended, created too much noise to easily think. Oddly, it was that which provided the possible solution. Sarah Lovell had as good as invited her and them over to play in the woods. What better place to find out what she needed to know? The next problem was how to deal with her husband, who came barreling in, riding crop waving, to demand why she was receiving strangers in the house.
Don't you mean strange men, Roger?
That calm inquiry threw him. He was all set for meek explanation. Her soft tone he found harder to deal with than noisy defiance.
It's damned unbecoming! What happens if it gets talked about?
The person most likely to talk about it is you.
C. Seeing him about to explode, she did finally shout, "Do you think so lowly of me that you would harbour doubts about my virtue, or allow anyone to impugn it? Perhaps Henry Tulkington will be able to say to you what he likes, and you will meekly accept it. I'm damned if I know what you mean."
Her voice dropped, but now it held a note of sadness.
"Don't you, Roger?
I've a damn good notion to let you feel this crop."
"Do so, husband, if it serves to make you feel like a man."
He had it up in the air, ready to strike, seemingly oblivious to the three young and alarmed faces just outside the door.
"But that would be better served by taking it to the man just mentioned. The pity is, you don't dare."
I
know, Roger. I want to ask you to tell me how I should feel about it. If you will not defend yourself, will you do that for me or the children?"
She had stopped him. It was in his eyes, slowly more obvious as the crop dropped to his side.
"Let me tell you what he has done to his own sister."
"I won't hear a word against the fellow."
Were words lacking in force.
"You will, and from me. Now pour yourself your dose of claret, which I suspect acts as a balm to your conscience, while I see the children fed."
When she came back, having given the orders for the children's meal, she saw him standing over the unlit fireplace. There was a glass of claret on the mantel, seemingly untouched, and by his posture it appeared all the passion, which was his normal mode of behaviour, had gone out of him. Annabel closed the door, and if he heard her, he did not turn around. So she told him about Betsy, in a low voice and without passion. She named Edward Brazier, the man her friend had wanted to wed, as the caller. It was only when she voiced her intention to help reverse matters that he reacted. "I forbid it, Annabel."
"Which means for the first time in our lives together, I will have to defy you."
"You can't fight Tulkington."
"You may not be able to, but I intend to try. What happened between him and you?"
"Don't tell me you did not guess."
She waited, hoping for more, but not sure it would come.
"He set his brutes upon me. Not that it was ever admitted by him. I met him afterwards, and it was as if he had no knowledge, but the words used by those beating me with clubs left me in no doubt of the consequences of defiance. So I dropped the boundary suit."
"You could have fought on. I would have supported you."
"Then you might have ended up a widow, and my children would have been without a father."
"You believe that?"
"After what you've just told me, I would be surprised if you do not."
He turned round, finally, showing eyes reddened by now dried tears. "Tulkington controls everything around these parts. I made discreet inquiries about having him taken up for what was done to me. It is at such times you find out who your friends are. No one was prepared to lift a finger."
"So you will appease him?"
"As I must. Until those mites sitting eating are old enough to take over from me, then, perhaps."
Annabel walked over and kissed him gently on the cheek, then took his glass from the mantel and put it in his hand.
"Drink it, Roger.
And Bella, or our mites will wonder if you've been struck down."
Upton was a poor reader of signs. It never occurred to him that Henry Tulkington, bringing his own mount into the stable a day before, signified anything. So when he said he was going to make a visit to the stud, taking the north gate key and one of the spare coach horses with him, and sure Miss Elizabeth would be out on her usual mid-morning walk, he saw matters as progressing nicely. Creevy, alerted to keep an eye out, was outside his master's study window, and informed him as soon as he saw the route Upton was taking. For all his desire for subterfuge, Henry was not one to go out in his indoor clothing. He required a cloak, a hat plus a muffler. Given there was no call for a coach or a horse, it engendered curiosity in Grady. Then, when he thought about it, a degree of alarm. Added to that was the knowledge that if it did point to trouble, he could do nothing to aid his friend.
So he busied himself with the tasks that filled his day, all done on this occasion with a silent prayer. The path Henry was on was not unfamiliar. It was just not one he took much pleasure in. He rarely walked anywhere by habit, which to his way of thinking was just another fundamental difference between him and his sister. There'd been some rain overnight, so the ground was soft enough to show the odd hoof print, and these he followed. Instead of taking him to the lake, as he had thought, they went in the direction of the north gate. He finally spied Upton, not far from where he reckoned the gate to be. Or to be more precise, he saw the horse he thought was normally hitched to his carriage, visible through the trees. Its moving head drew his eye as it cropped the grass. Upton came into view with a slight sideways shift. And there, too, was Elizabeth, deep in conversation, but very frustratingly much too far away to overhear. Not being a natural country fellow, Henry felt it would not do to seek to get closer. Then something occurred which rendered it unnecessary. Upton was holding up a key, one large enough to be seen at a distance, and it took no great imagination to work out what it might fit. Shoulder against an oak, he watched them talk. Saw the key being waved, in another part of his mind recalling that these two had always had a connection, one he was sure went beyond mere respect. Not trusting servants was not just a habit of his. It was a common topic when he met with others, not least their stupidity in the acts they expected to get away with. Was Upton plotting to help Elizabeth escape? He could very easily see the way it would be done, nor was there any doubt as to where she would go. The groom would suspect, since he never visited the stables or the stud, he would not know a horse was gone. With the gate padlock intact, he might not even suspect the means. Having seen everything he thought he needed, Henry crept back until he was sure he was well out of sight, then strode out for home. He must be back indoors before Elizabeth returned, which made him stop. What if she was planning to leave this very minute? Thinking hard, he concluded not. What he had observed indicated they had been plotting some future event. Back indoors, disrobed and in front of the fire in his study, he could warm his hands and consider how to handle matters. Upton had to go. But how to effect it? Would he seek to follow Elizabeth again, either the next day or the one thereafter? The thought of catching them in the act provided a delicious frisson of excitement. But that soon subsided. Henry chuckled at his own silent pun regarding shutting stable doors after his sister had bolted. But there was a serious side to that, which meant waiting was risky. Should he dismiss Upton with Elizabeth looking on as a signal her hopes were ever destined to be dashed, or just leave her to find out, which would have its own pleasures, albeit he would not witness her despair? If it were to be done, it were best done quickly, he said to himself, vaguely trying and failing to recall if that was a Shakespearean tag, when it was time to go in search of Creevy. I need to know when a certain party is seen returning. Come to my study window and knock once more.
Got it clear, Your Honor.
He waited impatiently until the gardener finally appeared and a knock was all he got. Elizabeth was already in and back to her room before Upton appeared, leading the horse he had taken out. The shock came when it was led into the stables, for Henry Tulkington was waiting for him, looking grim. Beside him stood the most senior of his boys, who could not look him in the eye.
"Mr. Tulkington, sir, two visits to your stables in 2 days. I's honoured."
"Honour," Henry said, seeming to roll the word around in his mouth. "Not, I think, given the circumstances, a word that is appropriate." Upton was thinking, but not about what he feared might be coming. It was the cook on whom he'd been sweet for such a long time. He could almost feel her lips, the stolen kisses, and the promise of so much more, the thought bringing a lump to his throat. This he fought to control. He was not going to break down in front of this man. "I know you are conspiring with my sister. I saw you this very morning. You have in your possession a certain key, the one that lets you out to the paddocks." A hand was held out, and once the object was fetched from his pocket, it was snatched from his hand. "I suspect on the coming visit you plan to use this to let my sister exit alongside you, to perhaps take out a horse already placed in the paddocks."
"I admit to talking with Miss Elizabeth on her walks, but it be because I've known her for years and I see her as lonely."
"That, Upton, is not your place."
"Didn't reckon it forbidden,"
came out with a hint of defiance. "How dare you assume what is permitted and what is not? That is for me to decide, as it is I who employ. And those I do, Upton, must have my complete trust that you have forfeited. So pack a sack with your possessions. I want you out of Cottington Court as soon as that is done." Henry drove home the disgrace by handing the key he was holding, which for many years had been Upton's to care for, to the lad who would succeed him. He, embarrassed, required a nod to accept it. "Your things." In his upstairs cubbyhole, as he shoved his possessions into a sack, Upton was left to ruminate on how little he had accumulated in his years of service. A set of slightly better clothes for the annual celebrations which took him to church, a few knick-knacks he'd fashioned in his spare time, and a pair of good boots he got as a gift from the saddlemaker for putting business his way. There was a set of kitchen implements provided by the visiting blacksmith, which were one day going to be put to furnishing the kitchen he and the cook had dreamt of. They were too heavy to carry, and would have to be left. From behind a loose and removed brick, he took a small leather pouch, a very limited stash accumulated over the years, mostly gifts from visiting gentry for care of their horses. It was money that would be going one day to pay for a wedding and the entertainment after. What did it matter now? That dream was shattered. Back down from the loft, sack slung over his shoulder. All that was needed to set him on his way was a hand gesture from Tulkington pointing towards the main gate. There were to be no farewells. None of the senior servants dared to show sympathy and watch him depart. To do so would anger their master. Even Tanner, well away from the house, had a care to keep his nod of farewell discreet. Outside the gate, thanking God he'd not been searched, he turned for Deal, feeling in his pocket the second key made as a copy by the blacksmith, the one he'd shown to Miss Elizabeth to compare with the original that very morning. He had wanted to give it to her, but she suggested it should stay with him until it was to be used, worried that whatever precautions they took, he would be accused of providing her with aid when she was found to be missing.
"Do you think it has not been observed, you taking the path to the lake when I'm out walking? What happens if my brother questions everybody, which he will surely do? Will they risk their place to lie to him about that? You need to be solid in your explanations, for it would grieve me that you should suffer. If the worst happens, I must send you to where you will find shelter."
He was to make for a place called Quebec House, but that would have to wait till the morrow. For tonight, he must find a place to lay his head. Chapter 24. Edward Brazier, as he walked through the town the following morning, was too preoccupied to notice anything unusual. Had he been more aware, he would have sensed every eye seemed to be upon him, people peering at him as if seeking something internal, rather than the fact of a naval officer merely making his way to wherever he was going. Perhaps his lack of awareness lay in the fact that he was accustomed to attention of that sort. Aboard ship, when the captain was pacing the quarterdeck with anything in the nature of action being imminent, he became the subject of excessive scrutiny, and for a very good reason. From him would flow whatever followed,
and seeking to guess what that might be was the common purpose of everyone, from the wasters to the premier. Duchy Holland, following a few paces behind, and Brazier's sole escort on this morning, had a sharper antennae, so sensed something amiss. Because no one was looking at him, he could see the way they were eyeing Brazier, to the point in one or two cases of stopping, once he had passed them by, to take in his back. The tasks of this morning were, first, to drop by the office of Saoirse Rawdon's lawyer and pay his rent, and to then go on and settle the various bills being run up to keep Quebec House going, food and fuel, plus deliveries of wine. This could have been entrusted to Joe Lascelles, but Brazier saw it as occupying him when he was in limbo. Some 20 yards behind him and Duchy, the grubby youngster trailing them was part of the scenery and no cause for comment. It would be his task to tell John Hawker where Brazier had gone, and who, if anyone, he visited, having been out and around the town the previous night, dispersing liberally in the article of bought ale. Hawker knew the cursing and coupling of Brazier and Pitt was coming to a satisfying head. This night, and after he'd settled his own bill, he would ensure it caught light. First, he had to make sure the other part of the intention knew what was required of him, unable to avoid alluding to the reward Tulkington had offered.
"You would never have got such an arrangement from me, Spafford. I would have tied you to the tiller of your lugger in deep water and then knocked out the bilge planking."
Spafford, his ruddy face part hidden by days of growth, managed a grin and a shake of his shackles.
"Can't wait to tell Tulkington you think he's gone soft." "He knows my thinking," Hawker growled. "So don't you go bothering. Sold any poor bugger to the revenue today?"
That had Hawker ball a fist. But it stayed by his side as a still-grinning Spafford drove home what was, in truth, a guess. It was based on a number of inexplicable happenings over many years about which, locked up here, he'd had time to recall and wonder about. Beach folk being nabbed at the same time as there were indications a Tulkington's cargo was coming in. It had clearly never occurred to Hawker that his way of playing both ends against the middle was not as clandestine as he supposed, and he was thrown off balance. Spafford drove the point home.
"Offer up a sprat to save Tulkington's mackerel, is it? Happen there will be a temptation to dob me in once I'm back at the trade."
"Why bother?"
was unconvincing, and told Spafford he'd hit a nerve.
"Tell that streak of piss you work for, if he tries that on me, every ear in Deal will know how many suffer with his blessing to keep him safe. You'll never get out of Deal alive."
"Who's going to believe the likes of Dan Spafford?"
came with a manufactured sneer.
"The same fools who fall for a fancy tale about some sailor cove being hand in glove with Billy Pitt. Who is he anyway? What's he done to get Tulkington so et up?"
"None of your concern. Just do as you're bid when darkness falls, then get back to grubbing for a crust. First you've got to talk to your men and tell them what's been arranged."
"They don't know yet."
Hawker just shook his head.
"Need to tell them what's been agreed, too."
"Up to you, Spafford. I'll have jugs of ale and some gin fetched in to get them in the right mood."
"What a caring soul you are."
Betsy, out on her walk, as was normal, wondered where Upton had got to. This was to be the morning in which he would let her out of the gate, using the key he'd contrived to have made, and immediately returned to the stables to cover his bag. A horse she could manage easily had been left in the paddock beforehand, for the notion of fetching along a saddle was too obvious.
"Best to leave the real key behind, Miss Elizabeth, forgetful-like."
Upton had said this with the air of a man pleased at his cunning.
"You must take the one I will use with you. Then, once you're out, I can go back to the stables and slap my head for the booby I am for leaving without the key. Any suspicions and you'll be far gone."
All she could do was make for the spot where the plot had been hatched,
and wait with mounting frustration mixed with anxiety, aware of time going by and the need not to be away from the house longer than was normal. With a sinking feeling, she finally began to retrace her steps as usual, when she entered the formal garden, taking a doffed cap and a greeting from Creevy. She was sorely tempted to cross to the opposite gate which led to the stables. That had to be resisted, so she went to and opened the front door, to find Henry in the hallway. Both his presence and the look on his face, a superior air, led her to suspect her plan had been thwarted. Not that she let on in any way, she just tried to ignore him. Grady appeared, as he always did, to take her cloak, his long face, a mask devoid of emotion. If something had happened to Upton, he would know about it, and if he'd never been as open as the groom, she was sure he felt sympathy for her. But there was no chance of showing any with his master standing close by. He was not going to let on by even a gesture. "That will be all, Grady," Henry said, which had the servant depart with more than normal haste. As Betsy moved towards the staircase, her brother sought to block her way. "Much as you may not wish it, Elizabeth, you and I are going to have a talk."
"We have nothing to discuss."
"Yes, we do. Not least how unsuitable was your choice of prospective husband." That required another sideways shuffle to block her attempt to progress. "I have learnt things about him that entirely vindicate my initial reservations. Call it intuition." Betsy actually laughed, a little forced, and louder than she felt it warranted, but enough to have the effect required. Henry hated to be laughed at more than anything, a fact she'd known from a very early age. It was a pleasure to see colour come to his pallid face, a sure sign of anger, proved by his grating tone. "It had been imparted to me that he may well have committed murder."
"Then I'm not the only one to think you stupid."
"Practice of your wit will not alter the facts."
"Facts? What you surely mean is your imaginings, or the bile someone has been pouring into your only too ready to listen ear. Now you will oblige me by standing aside and allowing me the stairs."
"So who killed Admiral Hassel?" Henry asked, expecting her to be shocked.
"A snake killed him. One of your venomous kindred spirits."
"You knew of this?"
"Not that it's any of your concern, Henry, but I knew of a great deal of idle gossip, most of it generated by jealousy at Edward's good fortune. To that was added a strong dislike in the planter community for a man who put his duty before the notion of popularity. Now do I have to push you aside, or will you get out of the way?"
"My God, you need to be tamed."
"I need to be free, brother, and that I will have."
She slipped by him and took the first riser, glad her back was to Henry when he said in a voice of studied calm, "Not with the help of Upton, you won't. That I can assure you." It was necessary to turn and look confused, difficult with a heart racing from disappointment.
"Upton? What about him?"
It was Henry's turn to produce forced laughter, very obviously, given there was no humour in it at all. But as he made for his study, he was meditating on the aforementioned taming, to a conclusion that there was one way it might be achieved. Not normally a man to be troubled by gossip, Daisy Trotter could scarce avoid taking an interest in what was being whispered, and in some cases openly espoused about dealing with Brazier. For some, there was only one way to deal with spies, and even excisemen too keen on their task. It had been sorted before, and it could be again. Everyone in Deal knew this referred to the burying of a revenue officer, one who'd been so bold as to take up residence in one of the alleys leading to Middle Street. This so he could keep an eye out for the running of contraband. He'd been assiduous in his application, too,
calling in his mates from Dover to raid houses and search cellars and attics and knock for concealed spaces. In both, he had enjoyed too much success. The way the authorities dealt with goods found in cellars, the favourite hiding place, was to fill them with beach shingle, so they could never be used again. The method by which the community reacted, and it was few who ever did so, was to visit the same fate on the overactive sod. No one was going to finger them. When he disappeared, there was a frantic search to find him, run by revenue men from all over the county. Someone must have passed over a whisper, for suddenly every shingle-filled cellar in Deal was being emptied. They found him in one, located in a street running from Beach Street to Middle Street. This housed the most prosperous farrier in Deal, and was generally named after that enterprise. He'd been interred under tons of pebbles, and with not a mark on him to say how he expired before or after. The horror soon spread that he'd been buried alive as a message to the revenue to stay out of the town. Should he care? Daisy didn't know. Certainly he could see a reason not to, given the way he'd been treated in the card room of the old playhouse. Yet it kept nagging him. When it came to taking on Tulkington and possibly getting Dan free, he was bereft of help. Brazier did not represent much of a chance to gain any, but there was none other possible. This left him dithering for near the whole of the day, at one moment determining to issue a proper warning, at others, with the sneering face of Brazier recalled, a determination to leave the bugger and the tars protecting him, too few in number to take on a Deal mob fired up with drink, to stew in their own juice. All he could do was keep an eye on the slaughterhouse and hope something would turn up. Saoirse Rawdon had a feeling something was looming. She had well-honed feelers for any trouble brewing in the town, a necessity given her location on the Lower Valley Road. If there were a riot, and if such things were infrequent, they were not unknown. She knew her business lay on the main thoroughfare for protest. She needed to be sure that as any mayhem went by, none of it got on to her premises. Being the tax gatherer's time to visit, she sought to quiz John Hawker.
"You sniffing summat that's eluded me, Miss Rawdon. And not much gets by John Hawker."
"I'd appreciate a warning, if there is."
"Do no harm," he lied. "If I pick up out on my travels, I'll send a message."
"Good of you," Saoirse replied. She was wondering why he was being so accommodating, a feeling that persisted after he'd departed. That was not the Hawker way, which did nothing to quieten her concerns. Had he been open, Hawker would have told her she was too friendly with certain people to be trusted with what was coming, not least Vincent Flaherty, and in some way, Brazier himself. And who was the true owner of the place about to be attacked? It was no secret she was his landlady, nor when he'd been subjected to a beating where he'd been looked after. The doctor who bandaged him was not discreet, and neither did he hold back on where the treatment he had administered was given. There was more than a hint that Saoirse Rawdon, noted for her immunity to male attentions, might have taken more than a shine to him. She, too, had errands to run connected with her business, food to order, a mass of materials to pay for, already delivered, which allowed her to drop hints with the various purveyors of services. But she was either talking to the wrong people, or those who had a sniff but were too unsure to let on. In blissful ignorance of that which was brewing, Edward Brazier was being entertained by his near neighbour, Miss Elizabeth Carter, not on his own, it had to be said. Yet he was well aware of being in the company of a group of some dozen people whose erudition vastly outstripped his own. It was for once a relief that they showed a degree of interest in his career and how he'd come about his rank.
"For Admiral Braddock vouchsafed to me, Captain Brazier, it did not come from the possession of interest.
There had to be one or two of the assembly who were singularly lacking that in its true form. But they would not dare to check the famous blue stocking, for Elizabeth Carter was a person to hold her own in any gathering. In her own house, she reigned supreme.
"I'm told it is the bane of the service, sir, the promotion to post rank of the undeserving for the mere quality of their connections. Do you agree?"
"I would rate it imperfect, Miss Carter. Yet I have met good officers who have come up in that fashion, as well as those who, as the expression goes, come to the Navy through the hawse hole. We have competent admirals who started